area map, just wanted to say good evening, and maybe we'll try to check in more often, but I got to jump out. I don't know if this is direct on that, so we're on stick and pick it up, but I got to jump out. Just wanted to say good evening all, and it's a very interesting conversation, and like I said, I'll try to tune in the future. This is W1EAV.
Very fine, Chris. I'm Vic, K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. We're down here on Long Island. You're up there in Massachusetts. And this is one of the very first times that these two repeater systems have been linked together with VOIP, I think it is. And the technical net on Long Island is something that has existed for 25 years, every Sunday night, starting at 8 o'clock, starting in roughly 1982. So you guys up there in New England are hearing it directly for the first time. For those who want to hear past issues of the technical net, and there have been in the past now 1,174 of them. If you go to the website of amateurradio.tv, we talk about television a lot. What a coincidence. Amateur radio, www.amateurradio.tv. Amateur and radio run together with a double R between the two. Amateurradio.tv. And you can dial in the right reel and listen to all the past technical nets. And the ones that are more than 2 weeks old, they're broken down every 5 minutes as to what subject is being discussed. So there are people who think there's an awful lot of technical information there that, from the various people who signed to this net and contribute to it. From time to time, I hear stories that some of the technical colleges in New Jersey, the professors at the college are recommending that their students, their engineering students, listen to some of the technical nets to learn some of the concepts of how wireless technology works. So quite a resource. I'm kind of amazed that Mr. Mike Perry, KC2NJI, Kilo Charlie 2, November, Juliet, India, is doing all that work of documenting all of these technical nets, a real labor of love as I see it. Oh, but great, he's doing it. Because from time to time, people will say, gee, I hear tell 3 weeks ago you guys talked about such and such. Can you mail me a tape recording of that? And the answer is no. I don't make tape recordings. You're listening to this stuff live. We make it up. Mel and I make it up as we go along. Mr. OHL, give me your full call letter, sir, and your name, and then proceed. My name is Dick, K2RIW, in the technical net. From what I hear, Howard, it's real this time. February 17th. I did call it February 9th in the past. February 17th, 2009, and from all I hear from all of the officials of FCC, National Association of Broadcasters, NTIA, and whatever, there's a lot of organizations. This is an act of Congress, and I give you a 95% probability it will take place. There are going to be people protesting that, hey, I used to watch soap operas, this is all I've got in my old age, and you can't take this away from me. Well, to a small degree, they're going to take it away from you, and they think they've provided the techniques by which you can continue to get over-the-air broadcast television information with a little bit of difficulty. Yes, the boxes are, if you buy the plain vanilla box for $70 and you get a $40 voucher for doing it, it's not too big an investment, and you got to find some relative if you're an elderly person who can do the installation for you. And in many cases, it's about as complicated as hooking up a digital tape recorder. And I know for many people who have all thumbs, that's very difficult. But hopefully they've got a relative that can do it. I'm hearing tell that some of the representatives and congressmen in various areas are putting forth bills by which help will be given to disadvantaged people so that they will have the ability to get the installation take place, and hopefully not a great big period of interruption when analog television ceases to exist. And I really think it's going to happen. I know you're skeptical of that. And yes, there have been previous dates that have come and gone, and it wasn't a reality. You listen to C-SPAN on a few times that they've had programs on this particular subject. You listen to the congressmen and the representatives discussing it, and I really think it's real this time, Howie. In fact, let me pass it over to Eric for that exact subject, if Eric is still there. KE2EJ, how real do you think it is that February 17th really is the cutoff date for NTSC analog over-the-air broadcast television? Go ahead, Eric. Alright, the way things stand now, you can forget about Congress trying to do anything about it. We'll see what happens in the next 6 months, but this is pretty much fixed. There'll be stations that'll be going off before the 17th. We may elect to do that, actually, because there's only so many transmitter manufacturers, and many transmitters need to be retrofitted on that day. So you can see that the transition is going to be somewhat scattered, you know, within a period of a month or so. So the reasons being the mass filters have to get changed. Many stations have elected to go back to the original frequency, whereas, say, for example, Channel 13, which now transmits their digital on Channel 61, will go back to Channel 13. Channel 21, which transmits their digital on 22, will go to Channel 21. CBS is on 56. I don't know where they're going. They're outside of the core. And digital television don't work too well on Channel 2, so it wouldn't really be wise for them to move back there, but I don't know what their story is yet. As far as the day changing, kind of doubtful. There's too much behind it, you know, and there's even companies like many PBS stations which have liens from PPFP and the other grant organizations are stuck with paying for a bill for a transmitter that they can't use anymore. So, you know, basically they're all going to turn around and try and say, hey, it's your government that did this, you take it. So, yeah. It's going to be interesting to see what happens. K2RIW, K2.
KEY, any comments?
One other comment, please.
Mel and Howard, in that order. And before I pass it over to either one of you guys, Eric, while you're still here, I've got a painful question, and that is, a high official of National Association of Broadcasters told me point blank a few weeks ago that as it presently stands, of the 1,800 television broadcast stations in the United States right now, on February 17, 2009, 50 of them intend to remain on VHF low. That means channels 2 through 6. Now, since they're going to be, by definition, on digital TV and on the low VHF channels, like channel 2, from what you just said, the multipath situation becomes more severe, if I understand correctly, on VHF low frequencies. I am guessing that the degree of correction that the digital converter box is able to accomplish maybe is more difficult. So what do you believe is going to happen to those 50 stations that will continue to use VHF low but digital techniques? Maybe it will not be high def. And I've got a second question on that, but I'll pass it to, after you answer those two questions, Eric, I'll go to those two guys, then come back for my question. Hope you can hang in there that long. KE2EJ, who, by the way, for those who are listening up in New England, Eric is the chief engineer of both Channel 13, one of the founders of National Public Broadcasting, Public Broadcasting System in New York City, and Channel 21, the sister station on Long Island. He's the chief engineer, so to some degree we're getting it from the horse's mouth. KE2EJ, K2RIW on the technical net.
By the way, dropped off IRLP.
Alright, here's the thing. The problem with the lows is not anything in terms of the modulation. It's terrestrial noise, it's all junk down there. You know, when you watch an analog TV and you see the little lines go through it, maybe you watch them, you go into your average person and watch them seeing through ghosts and everything. You as a human being can filter all that junk out. The digital stuff is very unforgiving. When it gets hit, and it's nastily, the picture goes away. It takes about a couple of moments for the picture to come back. One of the first DTV stations in Texas, in Dallas, they were on, if you remember way back there was the thing about the hospitals and all the white space medical gear that got messed up when they came on the air. They had a lot of experience at it, but it doesn't behave as nicely as it does once you get up past channel 6.
Is there a Viterbi type forward error correcting code built into the 8 VSB? And by the way, when you go over to 4 VSB for a mobile into a small screen, is it the same 8 VSB program where you only use 4 of those levels to get a slightly lower resolution picture? but you end up with a better signal-to-noise ratio? Is that approximately what's going on? So I can see how you get a lot more ignition noise and power line noise on channel 2 than you do on channel 7. And I think you're saying that the digital demodulation is not too tolerant of that. Back to you, Eric.
It was a big mistake. It's getting better. It's getting better, but yeah, impulse noise is a big problem. After all, the signals you're transmitting looks like impulse noise, but it's easy to get confused. There is a trellis coat on the outside, there's a TV on the inside, and even further than that, there's a convolution coat. So it isn't a question of air cracking. And by the way, you would never say that if you can get digital television, if you're getting digital television, you can get HD or SD. There's not a case where you can't get HD. Either you're getting the picture or you don't. It don't matter because you're getting that full 6 megahertz worth of scene as it actually exists. So, but impulse noise, think about that. I mean, even a noise blanket on your sideband radio, you know, how effective is it? K2RIW,
I'm kind of glad you mentioned that. There are noise blankers and there are noise blankers. A LAM noise blanker is one kind, but the noise blanker that was built into the Drake R4C receiver, which had a very fancy FET switch network, had extremely low capacitance, extremely fast switching, and the commanding for that came from a wide bandwidth stage up front in the IF strip. That particular noise blanker, when I was getting severe radar noise, very high duty factor radar noise from the FPS-35 radar, which ran gigawatts of power of its EIRP from Montauk Point, Long Island, in my backyard, there were times when I would aim my 432 Yagi to the west, and the deepest notch of the back of my Yagi antenna was aimed toward Montauk Point, about 50 or so miles from me. And that signal was still 120 decibels above my noise. I could plug in step attenuators to that magnitude in the front end of the receiver before I could kill it. I could disconnect the antenna on my receiver, and the leakage through the coax cables and power supplies would allow the burst of that radar to come through when the main lobe, when the Big Bang came by me. That was a potent radar. And most of the noise blankers that were turned on couldn't touch that. You turned on that noise blanker from the Drake R4C, aim my antenna down the throat of the radar, listen to a weak ham radio station on 432 in the back lobe toward New Jersey, and you wouldn't know the radar was there. That noise blanker was that good on sideband. So there are noise blankers and there are noise blankers. So maybe there's some corrective action that could take place there, Eric, I hope. I know that we've got both Mel and Howard in that order. Mel, I know you wanted to ask a question or make a comment. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, about the date. I see here that there was a thing that Senator Kruger, who is the senator here in this section of Brooklyn, who really got elected mostly by retired people, which we have a tremendous amount here in the she said they and the Brighton area, and their complaints, he says, are very wide, and he's going to introduce a bill to forestall this business with HD and all this changeover, because a number of his constituents have said that they would have to choose between eating that month or having their TV, because the $40 coupon only covers a small amount of their cost. They do not have, in many cases, anyone that can come to hook up the converter box. So between the converter box of costing an additional $30 and these companies that are now selling them, as I mentioned before, four or five places are handling them, are charging between $35 and $50 to install. It comes to the house technician to install. So it comes up to, in many cases, close to about $100 investment. And he wants to know who's going to pick up that cost. And until he gets a relatively good answer, he's going to put a bill in to forestall the changeover, takeover.
Okay. I'm going to pass it over to Eric for a comment on this, but I think his bill to do forestall
I give it a 90% chance of failing. I think Congress and the National Association of Broadcasters, the NTIA and the FCC are going to say, what does the most good for the most number of people? The frequencies that are going to be left over when all this transition takes place are going to be given to first responders. They've been calling, they've been screening for a lot more frequency for a lot of time. So a lot of lives will be saved as first responders, your fire, police, and ambulance and whatever have better communication. Yes, a few people in, elderly people in certain communities like yours are going to suffer a disadvantage for a certain period of time. But that is not life-threatening. It is a strong inconvenience. It's a strong annoyance. But I think they're going to make a decision as to what does the most good for the most number of people. I am convinced they're going to go through with it. Let's see what Eric feels on that one. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the technical net.
All right, Dick, K2RIW, K2EJ. You have to take this as a personal opinion. Because there's a couple of issues. As much as that I would like to believe that's true, if you've looked at what Kevin Martin has done over his term, there's some things that are kind of hard to believe because all the WiMAX people and the other folks are, you know, drooling at the auction. But the reality is, in terms of public safety, you have individual in each organization, fire department, that chooses their radios. And it doesn't seem like there's any one standard to give them interoperability. There are a few, but, you know, why they don't choose them is beyond me. As far as, like, all this extra wonderful space for public service, it's only a small segment, but not the whole picture. So there's a lot of money behind it. And the government, as it is, likes when it can make money. So you put that in your head and, you know, swirl it around a little bit. But it remains to be seen. K2RIWK2J.
Now, I'm going to be hitting you with a question that may be a little bit unfair, Eric. I'm hitting you cold, but I've been told by somebody who thinks he knows that during the Clinton administration, supposedly Hillary Rodham Clinton came up with the idea of selling the frequencies. And cell phones and other services paid some pretty big bucks to buy the frequencies that they are using, and that the total cash flow is a large number of billions of dollars, and that is the reason why during the Clinton administration the budget appeared to be balanced, and really was balanced. And there are people who think that, gee, the Clintons were so crafty they managed to cut back expensive programs and economically buy other programs so that everybody was happy, and they balanced the budget at the same time. And this person was telling me that it was the selling of these frequencies and the huge cash flow that created is what created the balancing of the budget at that time. Do you believe there's any truth in that particular story, Eric, if you happen to know? KE2EJ, K2LAW in the tech man.
Alright, well, I've heard three different versions of that. And I think there's a bunch of things that the Clintons did that was not very good for the public in terms of broadcasting. But again, we're talking opinion here. Ronald Reagan started with killing the Fairness Doctrine, and Bill Clinton killed it altogether, and the things that were left, which was not a very nice thing. You're talking to someone who's in public broadcasting, so I guess I have a right to feel that way. It's the kind of thing that has been done, and the concept, I believe, was like created during Reagan, but because of the folks that were the chairman at the FCC and his board members, they had the majority. That didn't actually happen in those days. The other thing that people fail to mention is that of some of the companies that pay the billions of dollars that never were able to sell their services, that they went broke. So, you know, that money had to go somewhere. K2RIWK, KJ.
Yeah, if I paid big bucks for a frequency allocation and didn't get a chance to use it, didn't get a chance to create it into a cash flow, and my company therefore goes out of business, I guess I could end up a little bit unhappy and say, gee, I've been cheated. And he who sold it to him, the frequency allocation, will say, use it or lose it. That was the deal that you signed up for. Too bad there isn't some friendlier way there that you could get some of your money back if you didn't get a chance to use it, but I can see why you would not. Okay, Howard, I speak just a little bit softer into your microphone, Howard, if you're going through the previous channel that you did go through. You got it, Howard. KQLAW on the technical net.
All right, well, and Eric, you need to get up there and lower the level. Here's what I'm going to say. You're not taking into account what could the courts do. If the courts come in and say this has to be halted, then it'll be a food fight all the way up to the Supreme Court. So, yes, you may be right that Congress does not want to move. And, yes, you're correct about Hillary doing this. So you have to take into account what do the courts do. No one is thinking about it. If somebody gets an injunction, it could take a couple of years to unravel this injunction. So, you know, don't say it's over to the fat lady sings. Back to you, Nick.
Yeah, there was a famous baseball catcher at the New York Yankees named Yogi Berra who said, it ain't over until it's over. Okay. It ain't over. I still think it's going to happen. And, Eric, when you talked about some of the stations are going to make this transition beforehand, I know that trial and error is going to be required to get all the bugs out of the system. Couldn't some of those stations that are going to go back to using their old frequencies, but using with digital as opposed to analog, couldn't they declare a period of time at 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the morning in which they do these experiments, starting essentially now, to get all the bugs out of the system, and then make the official transition sometime between now and February 17th. So they don't have to literally, for the very first time, do the transition then and find out all the bugs in the system. I think they could do some trial and error at 2 in the morning right now, because their total audience at 2 in the morning in most stations, I'd like to believe, is fairly small. But maybe I'm wrong. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the technical net.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, actually, March 26th, you have to have files with the FCC what your transition plans are. And any additional construction permit applications have to be put in, which includes going off the air early, making your transition on time or late, because there's no experimenting to be done. The experimental days are over. We know what we're doing. It's just a matter of doing it. If you have a transmitter that's dead, you've got to change frequency, and or you're just changing from an analog to a digital. You have to take out the existing digital sideband filter and put in these special mass filters depending upon what size transmitter you have and how much your TPO is going to be. A lot of these things are big plumbing jobs. Depends on how the frequency is. For example, you've seen the waveguide at channel 21. That's pretty big. Well, it just so happens that big round filter that's in the end, and there's tracks that we use also, makes it so that taking that stuff out is a huge plumbing job. It takes time. So there's lots of stuff like that. But as far as the transition goes, all of the predictive stuff like Langley Rice, all that stuff has been done already. So they know what the coverage area is, they know what the given TPO is, they know what the co-channel maps look like, because in digital, co-channel is much more of an issue than it was in analog.
KQRIWKA2J. Yeah, your co-channel, adjacent channel power ratio has probably done in a small noise power density specification. In other words, per kilohertz or per 100 kilohertz or per megahertz of the adjacent channel, you're not allowed to exceed X amount of power. Is that number something like minus 80 dBc on the adjacent channel power ratio? Roughly, what's that number? I'm kind of curious, Eric. Go ahead.
You know, that sounds about right. I think it's a little deeper, but don't quote me. I would really have to look it up to be accurate to share that. My guess is that you're somewhere close, but I think it's a little more than that.
So it really requires a brick wall filter with a good number of poles and just the right coupling coefficients. Roughly how many poles in that final filter are required to guarantee adjacent channel? Because
no matter what you're using for the final amplifier, when you're running 60,000 watts, the word linearity is a very relative word. You could be linear to the point where your third order intermodulation distortion is 60 dB down, but because it's such a complex, spiky signal and you're transmitting, the bar said that it's going to give you some regrowth. So therefore, that filter has got to do a lot of work. Simply how many poles of filtering is required to do the job correctly, Eric Graham?
All right, well, most of these things are cavities. My experience is with the UHF one. I haven't really seen the VHF one, so I can't give you a really good answer. But consider this. The FCC rules is that if you have a signal that looks like noise, it's broadband, at its band limit, there's a specification as far as, you know, at what rate the skirts have to be, you know, as far as what the rise time of that signal has to be. Okay, and it's something in the order of 40 kilohertz from start to finish. So you figure the rise time of that, and that's, I think it's, I don't remember what the number is, it's a couple nanoseconds. How much filtering do you need to take a broadband thing and make shoulders like that?
I would guess that near state-of-the-art of filtering, and we're talking about some pretty big bucks for that assembly. Out of curiosity, what brand name company is capable of making a piece of hardware like that, Eric?
Well, they're passive devices. They're made by, well, of course, the number one maker of those things is Dielectric. And then there's ELI, there's Andrew. They make lower power versions. Actually, in terms of cost, my mass filter can handle about 7 kilowatts. That's around $60,000. The one that we probably need up at 13, I think that's a little heftier. It's a heck of a lot bigger. $75,000, something like that. And the little guys, you know, I don't know what the little guys cost, but they can't be more than a couple thousand bucks a piece. But, yeah, they have to meet the spec, and as long as they meet the spec, then you're done.
Hey, Shelly W, you want a question for Eric, for Dick?
Okay, I'm going to give you that question in a second, Howie. Howie, now that we're talking about sizes, dollars, and whatever, and because of the World Trade Center loss, essentially everything in New York City in television broadcast is from the Empire State Building. And that's got to be the most valuable piece of real estate on the planet to get enough raw power into the top of that building to run all those transmitters, to get enough feed line between the transmitters and the antennas to install those antennas on the mast. I'm sure a lot of transition has occurred. I would guess there's very little spare space left on the top of that building for transmitters, feed lines, or antennas. Am I approximately right? Is it a little bit tight up there, Eric? KQEJ, KQLIW?
Well, that's a whole other night of story, especially when we're putting all this stuff in. I mean, most people don't realize, Empire State Building, yeah, it's built out of steel, but it's actually built with bricks, and there were fireplaces in the place, and that can reduce some of the fireplace where you get some of the cable around. And the building is so old that you can't load it more than 300 pounds per square foot, so where we put the transmitters, usually we had to chop out the floor, add some more beams, pour some more cement, and reinforce it so that it would hold the darn thing. But Empire is not the only place that's active. It's 4 Times Square, which is has ABCs there. There's a few people there. Cal 41 is there full-time. They're not even on Empire. You know, since 9/11, the concept is we will not just have one transmitter in one place, as far as the commercial guys are concerned. We're going to do that with the 13. We're going to set it up so that there's a backup transmitter in plain view and the other way around. So, we'll see where that takes us. But, yeah, I'm fine. It's pretty dense, I'll tell you. The interesting part about the real estate is that the now cost of analog rent goes down and the cost of digital rent goes up. Funny way they charge the space. Peter R.W. Page is that.
I think you're saying that the Empire once had a certain number of dollars per square foot if you're running digital, and dollars per square foot for analog, and at one time analog was expensive, digital was cheaper, and now it's going the other way around. Is that what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. It sounds to me that's like what the traffic will allow. If you were the general manager of the Empire State Building, do you think you would have chosen to make that kind of a change?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the way things are going. Actually, it cost, $10 million just to be part of Liberty Tower, because, you know, they're actually planning that now. So they will eventually move to it. It seems like about everybody signed on, or at least six stations signed on, WNAP being one of them.
Yeah, I think it takes $10 million to have a placeholder in the Freedom Tower, which is supposed to be 1,776 feet tall, 1776, the year of our founding. And I think there are people who believe the building will be constructed and completed by the year 2012. I'm very skeptical about the year 2012, in which case if you spend the 10 megabucks for a place holding, to have a place in that new locale, and you think the money is going to be held there until 2012, and if it doesn't really get finished until 2015, it seems like the investment's a little bit different than you think. On top of that, would there be no space left over if you didn't pay the placeholder now? If you put the placeholder in later, and even if you didn't get the top of the mast, if you're 100 feet down from the top of the mast, when you're 1,776 feet high, you really got most of the altitude you need. Am I naive in some of these guesses, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
Okay. I'll give you this much. There's a definite difference between coverage when we were at the World Trade Center before it went and disappeared and what we get from Empire, let's say. The few feet helps, you know. It's simple trigonometry, you know, angle. That's all it takes. More feet, better look, further you can see. That helps, especially in digital.
Yeah, what I'm saying, though, is that your radar, your line of sight goes up as the square root of altitude. Well, if I'm comparing 1,700 feet to 1,776, and I'm taking the square root of those two numbers, the difference in range is not huge. So even if you got the bottom of the mast, and I take the square root of that altitude, and I buy the less premium location, but I don't lay down my money until the year 2014 when it's really operational, and I've got that money in my pocket working for me between now and then. I didn't say it's the ideal way to go, but it's something I'd want to consider. Back to you, Eric, if you have any further comments on that.
Yeah, well, the way I understood it was presented as either you join or you don't, because they're going to design the antenna to whatever it is. Because this is a community antenna, and that's it. That's the way the building is designed. The add-ons is something that's not going to happen. So I think they were like cornered on this one, but it's done.
Okay, community antenna. Does that mean one single antenna structure is going to try to cover every single channel, DC to light, and broadcast television? Is that what you're saying, Eric? And if so, my goodness, is that a difficult engineering problem. Go ahead.
Well, the antenna that was on top of the World Trade Center for the broadcast is a community antenna. It was designed by Bedem Odem of RCA, who then became the chief engineer and president of Dielectrics, who has since moved on. I'm still around. I don't know who's working for now, but he's quite an amazing man. But that was a structure that contained a radiator for each channel. And the way they make UHF antennas today is one stick covers from, you know, channel 17 to channel 50. And actually, the DTV that's coming off of Empire is one DTV antenna, which is owned by CBS. And that's got channel 2, channel 4, channel 7, that's got channel 11, 13, I think that's it. And Fox has their own side mount antenna, so they've got channel 5 and 9.
Well, you know, the digital equivalent exactly is 38 and 44.
Six. Now, there could be something wrong with my particular chimney-mounted television receiving aerial, but I'm getting nowhere near as much signal strength on channel 4 as I am all those other channels, and it's all coming out of that same antenna. Is there the possibility that the up-tilt or down-tilt or the pattern out to the east where I am on channel 4 is a little bit different than the others, or do you think the difference could be on my end? Eric, go ahead.
No, you're dealing with the fact that Empire doesn't have a community antenna. Everybody's got antennas in different spots, you know. They've got, let's see, channel 4 is down by, I think they're below the 102nd floor. I think channel 5, the low V is the down at the bottom. Actually, if they're on their standby antennas, the standby antennas are on the 81st floor. If you ever look at the Empire State Building, you see in two corners there, almost all the way up, but not all the way up where there's still windows, you'll see two ugly antenna arrays sticking out of the side of the building, and that's channel 4 transmit standby antenna. And then below them is the high V standby antenna. So, yeah, each station, if you look at the map, you'll see the bumps are in different places. You know, they're not all perfectly symmetrical.
Is there that much construction going on up there, Eric, at this time, that they're periodically on the standby antenna, and that's why I'm getting a picture that's not so great on channel 4? Is there that much construction going on this many years downrange from 9/11? Go ahead.
Yeah, actually there is, and they haven't quite finished yet. No, they actually just finally finished reinforcing the mooring mast. The thing's been loaded a lot more than it was intended to, so it took them almost 2 years to do it. Yeah, there's little things that are going on now. Plastic stuff has been blowing up, so I see. On the standby antenna, somehow or other, they managed to get two kinks and 3.5-inch heliac. Made some sense, but it's very unhappy.
Like you said, there's all kinds of stories up there. Were there human beings on that mast welding on extra gusset plates to beef it up during the time that low-power transmission was taking place at 2 o'clock in the morning? Is that approximately the scene that I'm describing, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, that would happen on a very regular basis. Usually after Leno and Letterman, they make the switch. They go to the antennas on the 81st floor. It generally didn't affect the low Vs, but the low Vs, when they did get affected, they went down to like the 89th floor, I think is where they're standby though.
Question mark 6, W2WK.
Okay, Eugene, we've got one questioner before you. I've been holding off poor Howie here. Howie, go ahead with your question or comment first, and then we'll pick up Eugene second. Howie first, go ahead.
Slightly off topic, but as long as Eric is here. Eric, this is directed to you. Channel 6 is running music. There's a Russian station coming off of the Citicorp building. How do they get that? How do they wiggle that through the FCC? They're not in their audio carrier. Is not in the right place for TV, and they're not in the right place for FM broadcast. Do you know the story about that?
Oh, you know who he's talking about. Mr. Bodner is—he's in his mid-70s now, and that station actually was the result of a bet that was made, and the aim of it was to, you know. Some radios go down a little bit below 88.1, and guess what you can pick up? But yeah, that's a long, funny story.
I'll allow you to go ahead. I'd be curious. And are they running 25 kc deviation, or are they running 75? And how did they get Australia? How did they get the pilot carrier? I'm very curious if Dick O'Keefe will permit you to tell that story. It's a very interesting story, Dick.
Yeah, well, Dick is the king of low-power TV, by the way. He's got the most low-power stations all over the place. But they have to conform to TV standards, which is 25 kilohertz deviation. You've got everything in it. You can try and bend the rules. Actually, I have a friend who has a station up in Alaska. He bends the rules for the sake of being a pain in the FCC rear end. That's another funny story. I mean, that's a homebrew TV station. He's a Fox station, too. It's funny as all heck, but it's an amazing story. Some guys just like to play with our government, if you know what I mean.
Sounds like Howie's got no further questions. Is that true?
It was okay. I have a couple more questions. You're being a little vague. What did he do? Did he actually, now, that's 25 KC, but how did he get his stereo out of that? The stereo pilot light goes on. You have to use an analog tuner, because it won't exactly lock up. They're on 87.6. I think it's 87.6 or something like that, or 77. And, you know, if you watch the video signal, it's just a test pattern. That's all it is an FM, there's a TV station, they're using it to do music. It doesn't sound that great, actually, over the, Eric.
All right, to make a long story short for you, Howard. FM stereo, 75 kilohertz deviation. The pilot is 19.5 kilohertz up, right? And it's locked to an oscillator that runs at 38. Well, in television, BTSC, which is a different standard, okay, 25 kilohertz deviation. The pilot is at 15.735 kilohertz, which is the locked to the horizontal frequency. And, the way it's injection is actually a lot lower than what the normal FM. So if you tuned it with your car stereo, you won't get stereo, you'll only get mono. So that's just the way it works. Does that help?
I don't know how they did it visually, but that's pretty interesting. Over here, it's just a double dot broadcast. Let me back away from the mic because I think the level's a little bit hot coming out. So, over to you, Dick, K2RIW, WB2HW, very interesting.
Yeah, when you back to us from the mic at the end, you did exactly the right amplitude, Howie. Up till then, you were loud enough that occasionally words would get chopped out as you exceed the deviation of the machine. So something in the system between you and it is a little bit hot. I noticed that Mel and I get quite a bit of favorable mail when we get into the subject of broadcast. Radio broadcast television. I think inside of every ham radio operator is a scientist trying to get out and a broadcaster that's trying to get out. So we are really interested in that subject. We amateur radio operators, we do narrow casting usually. This is the closest we get to broadcasting a network on a major New York City repeater that covers portions of a tri-state area. And people call in with that question. I know that Eugene had a question or a comment, so go right ahead, Eugene. W2EWK, K2RIW in the technical man.
Okay, W2EWK, we turn back to you, Dick. Dick, I got a very, very, very important question. It's bugging me now. And I think you're the man I should ask, okay? Now, when you get the cable TV boxes, okay, I got a question mark. What type of antenna do you put onto it, and where do you buy the antenna? Where do you buy this antenna from? Do you make it? Do you go to the ARRL handbook? Or that's my question mark, when you get the box.
Hey, you did say cable television, and there's a little bit of confusion here. A small percentage of the population in a metropolitan area like New York City is using over-the-air broadcast. In other words, they're not using cable TV, they're not using satellite TV,
And they're not using a video cassette recorder or a DVD. They really got an antenna, either a rabbit ear on the top of the set or an antenna mounted on the chimney of the house, which in theory is aimed toward the Empire State Building or Times Square, and they're getting over-the-air broadcast. For the people that are exclusively over-the-air broadcast, whatever their antenna they're using right now, I am guessing there's a high probability that antenna will continue to work when you purchase the brand new digital TV receiving box. That's a box that sits on top of your set, takes a digital signal in from your current antenna, converts it to an analog signal, maybe channel 3, and pours it into your television set as an analog signal of channel 3, or if you've got a slightly more sophisticated box, it plugs it in as a composite video or an S connector or red, green, blue, or whatever. But it feeds your normal TV set the digital converted signal to analog. A slightly more affluent person will just bite the bullet, write the check, and go out and buy a real modern-day digital television. And by FCC rules, all the televisions sold these days at any reasonable screen size must have the digital receiving box built in. So that's over-the-air broadcast. If you're a cable television provider, your cable television provider is smart enough to say, okay, you're a person that doesn't have a digital set, you've got an analog set, I make sure that the box I give you in your house to receive cable television will continue to give you television when the transition occurs. You'll never know there's anything different. So if you're a cable television subscriber, and maybe to some degree if you're a satellite television subscriber, those services will supply you the right box and you will know the difference. That's my understanding. Well, let me pass it to Eric and see if I'm close to be on the money on this one. KE2EJ. K2LIW in the technical net.
I'm talking about when you get this new digital box, can you go out and get the special antenna for the box, the converter box?
Okay, you haven't made it clear. Are you a person that's going to receive over-the-air broadcast television, or are you a cable television subscriber? Which are you, Eugene?
Over the air. When I go to buy that box that say over PC Richards, I bring it home, connect to my TV. Now, can I get the special antenna port for my HD TV?
Take it, Dick. Yeah, I think the antenna is not special. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, if you get a pretty decent picture with your TV now, you tune in channel 4, you get a good picture. If you tune in channel 13, you get a good picture. All you have to do is put the cable box in there. You don't have to change anything else. Chances are it'll work just fine.
Okay, that's what I meant. Now, if I do get the special antenna, would I pick up more stations better?
Well, here's the thing. If you can pick up the stations, you can't get it any better. More stations, well, depends on where you live. There's stations in New Jersey, there's stations in Connecticut, there's stations on Long Island. Point an antenna at each direction, and you pick them up. Some people put rotors on their antennas so they can do that. But if you're just pointed at the Empire State Building, you'll be very happy because you'll actually be getting more stations than you get now.
Hey, here's a great question for you, Eric. For a short period of time, I was a member of the Worldwide Television FM and DX Association. And these characters were putting up tall towers, big antennas, television receiving aerials with rotators and preamplifiers and whatever. And they would brag to each other in month-to-month the issues as to, hey, I received television from 1,200 miles away. I watched channel so-and-so from Chicago. And here's the Polaroid picture I took off my screen. We haven't heard about it yet, but I think it's only a matter of time before there will be digital television DXers who put up big antennas with rotators and pride themselves in getting channels from far away. What do you think, Eric? Fred?
No, I do that already. And you'd be surprised the amazing amount of skips that can happen at times. You've just got to be aware of it. But actually,
It's interesting, because you have to have a different kind of patience. But at least with the analog, you could just sort of see the thing, and then eventually as the band opens a little more, the picture would get a little, smell would get a little less, you'd start to see a picture. Don't work that way with digital television. If anything, you have a second analyzer on your antenna, or some kind of pan adapter, so you can see the signal, and wait for it to get to a certain level, and all of a sudden, snap, you have a perfect picture.
Okay, an interesting discussion occurred between Mel, I, and a person I can't find him on my list here. 1 week ago or 2 weeks ago, when you were in Hawaii, a man came along who said, I bought this $275 digital television converter box. He gave us the model number, the name, and he told us it's got a continuous bar chart on it where you can aim the antenna and you can peak the antenna for the digital signal, and it will tell you when it's getting better. Now, was it looking at bit error rate or just pure signal strength? I don't know. But he had a real seemingly analog amplitude display device, which appeared on the screen when he would put it into that mode, which allowed him to aim the antenna. It didn't have this hard threshold characteristic that everyone is telling me that real digital television reception will have, that this particular box had this signal strength indicator. And he could start off with 19 counts and tune the antenna and get it up to 39 counts, and the picture became more and more reliable on that particular channel when he did it. So somebody appears to have maybe solved that problem of a no good way of knowing when you've tuned it correctly, the antenna. What do you think, Eric? KQ2EJ, KQLIW in the TechNet.
I'm sorry, repeat that again for me, Dick.
Okay, there was a guy who signed in 1 or 2 weeks ago to the TechNet telling us that he bought a $275 digital television converter box that he put on top of his analog television, and when he puts it in a certain mode of operation, the $275 thing, there it is, $250, the brand name is Pro Brand 3150 Plus. Pro Brand 3150 Plus. The guy was, I think, Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, John, who told us about this thing. And it has a mode of operation where it has a signal strength indicator. You can be aiming the antenna, moving the rabbit ears, whatever, and he would go from count number 19 to count number 35 and had a continuous display of when he was making the antenna better to receive that particular television channel. The Pro Brand 3150 supposedly does that. KE2EJ, KQLAW in the TechNet.
Okay, K2RAW, K2EJ, I got that.
All digital tuners have a signal strength, what they call a signal strength meter. It's really not signal strength. What it is the error rate. Remember we talked about the equalizer earlier. What it actually does, the equalizer gives a cumulative value. As the error rate goes down, that bar goes up. So as you tune to the station and you get it with the least amount of reflections, you get the highest reading on the meter. But all of them have it. It's not just restricted to that one particular model receiver.
Okay. When I asked a person from National Association of Broadcasters that question a couple of weeks ago, he told me that that couldn't be done, that it's a hard threshold. You either get the signal or don't get the signal, and there's nothing in between. And maybe he and I had a communication problem. But now, I'm anticipating what's about to happen next, Eric. There's going to be some enthusiastic electronic enthusiasts out there that put up a tall tower, a preamplifier, a great big antenna, rotator, maybe even a phased array or whatever, and they're going to start DXing television high def or digital television DXing during a sporadic E opening where they're getting a signal from 1,200 miles away. Do you believe the minus 75 and plus 250 microseconds of compensation capability of the current fifth generation converter boxes are going to be able to tolerate that particular situation? There you're going to get multipath that has tremendous differences in amplitude and time delay. KE2EJ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
K2RWK, here you go. Yeah, well, you must have had a communication error with him, because that does actually and has existed since the very first one. It's really error indication, I suppose, signal sense. There are active antennas that work in feedback with the receiver and equalizer to maximize. There's actually a guy who invented, he's got a couple patents on it. It's a self-phasing antenna. It's a weird little device. The UHF works quite well. But, yeah, there is something called the ABC forum. And there you will find people who are, have been for a number of years putting up big antennas and looking for TV stations and talking to DX and that kind of stuff. So it's really not new. It is, already exists now. But...
Okay. So, bit error. I specifically asked this person, couldn't I build a signal strength indicator that was not telling me signal strength, but was telling me the first cousin of it, bit error rate of the demodulator? And he told me he thought the answer was no. I think you're saying you're fairly sure the answer is yes. Let me get a repeat on that one, Eric. Go ahead.
Yes, you could build a meter, but effective, probably not very, because of the nature of the signal. But yeah, there are field strength meters designed specifically for it to give you accurate readings. You know, they're DSP based, but sure, you could build something like that, no problem.
A couple of years ago at the Computer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, there was a kind of a smart antenna that looked like a drill bit. Internally, it contained three log periodic Yagis aimed in three different directions for UHF-ception reception, and the electronics connected to it had a three-direction phase control where it could decide how much amplitude it's going to select from each one of those three directions of the antennas. Therefore, it could electronically tune itself for the best combination of reception, giving you the lowest bit error rate for reception of that digital television. I'll bet you when you were there, you saw that thing. I got a picture of it. It was right side of a, it was shown on a table right alongside of a major brand name, I can't think of it right now, of the actual display device. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, it was actually in a hotel room at the Hilton, the NAB. We had one there, I think it was 3 years ago, 4 years ago. Anyway, he came up with the method of piggybacking QAM on top of your analog TV and not have the viewers notice. Although I saw it, actually the company that was using it went bust, but it's an interesting modulation scheme.
Interesting modulation scheme. QAM on top of 8VSD, is that what you're saying? There's ways of simultaneously transmitting that in the same 6 meg channel without one jamming the other?
No. Analog video and QAM together. If you have been watching Channel 21, if you look really carefully, you've seen a very light hashing in the picture. That is actually the QAM that was being injected 1.2 megahertz up from the base of the carrier.
And that QAM is doing what? I guess I don't know. Is that another channel of programming, or is that some kind of control signal?
Well, we had this discussion. It was for movie beams. They essentially had a 3 megabit stream that was piggybacked on various analog transmitters all over the country. Their box is basically an antenna with a hard drive, and it downloads every night with the movies, and you buy the movie that you want. And it used QAM that was literally laid on top of the analog portion of your television signal. Analog.
Understand, and this is the store and play.